Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 8. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 32. I'm going to call this section Frogs, Gnats, and Flies. The frogs is the second plague on Egypt. The gnats is the third plague, and the flies is the fourth plague. Our context is this. In chapter 7, we looked at the first plague, where the Nile River was turned to blood, or something that was like blood, like red algae is what I think it is. We go now to Exodus 8. We start verses 1 through 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. The Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed and into the houses of your servants and on your people and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. So the frogs will come up on you and your people and all your servants.'" Now, that's just a long way of saying the frogs are going to be everywhere. The ovens were holes made in the ground with the sides plastered with mortar. There'd be frogs there. There could be frogs in their bed. Usually frogs don't go into somebody's house because they usually like to stay outside. They're timorous, as John Gill says. John Gill describes the frogs this way, quote, "They had a, quote, ugly shape, croaking noise, and filthy smell, and the disagreeable touch of them, leaping on them, and even upon their food and all vessels used for the same, which must make it very nauseous and distasteful to them." Well, I guess it was. Now, why did the frogs come up at the Nile at this point? Because God, I'm sure, encouraged the frogs to do that. Well, of course, it hasn't happened yet. This is just Moses threatening it. But when it does come up, the frogs coming up might be related to the blood that was in the Nile previously, which I think is that red algae. The Nile was formerly a source of blessing, but after the Nile had come under judgment of God, it became a curse, and it thrust up these nasty frogs. Now, as we go through these 10 plagues, we need to show that all the plagues were designed by God to make a mockery of the Egyptian gods. The first one is the god Heket, which is the Egyptian god of the frog. The frog god. Heket is spelled variously. The way I've got it spelled here is H-E-Q-T. Heket. It was the god of fertility, assisted women in childbirth. But now the great, lovely frog god is going to become a curse to the Egyptians. They're going to look at a frog. They're not going to think about fertility and little babies. They're going to think about ugly, croaking noise and filthy smell, something that's nauseous and distasteful. Now we go to Exodus 8, 5 and 6. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the streams, and over the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt.' So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt." Now the Lord said to Moses, how did he do that? Well, John Gill says it was by secret impulse because Moses was in the presence of Pharaoh. But it doesn't say that Moses is in the presence of Pharaoh. If you recall, the last verse of chapter 7 said that it was 7 days that the Nile was bloody. So there was a 7-day period there when Moses and Aaron left Pharaoh after turning the Nile into blood and had gone back to Goshen. Now, 7 days, God could have said to Moses, however he talked to Moses, dreams, angel of Jehovah, I don't know, vision, secret impulse, as Gill put it. But at any rate, I don't think this was in the presence of Pharaoh, as Gill says. "Now stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers." There aren't any rivers in Egypt that I know of besides the Nile. That's probably referring to the 7 branches of the Nile. Once you get to the northern of the Nile River, the lower Nile, the northern part, right before you go into before it flows into the Mediterranean Sea, those will be the rivers. The streams, it's speculated, could possibly be the canals connecting the 7 branches. I don't think there were a lot of streams in Egypt by themselves. It's a very dry climate. But at any rate, it's just all the water. Over the pools, that could be reservoirs that were built to hold water, rainwater, cisterns. I don't know. But all these water-holding places were full of frogs, which means they had a hard time drinking water. They already had a hard time drinking water with the blood-red water out of the Nile. Now they got frogs everywhere in the water. Now, the miracle of the frogs was not in the frogs per se. The miracle was in the timing, that they came out right when Moses and Aaron stretched forth the rod. That's when the frogs came out. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, it's not the miracle. There's nothing miraculous about a frog coming out of the water, but when they all come out at the same time, well, now that's pretty miraculous. We go now to verses 7 through 11 in Exodus 8. The magicians did the same with their secret arts, making frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Entreat the Lord that he remove the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go, that they may sacrifice to the Lord." Moses said to Pharaoh, "The honor is yours to tell me. When shall I entreat for you and your servants and your people, that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses, that they may be left only in the Nile?" Then he, Pharaoh, said, "Tomorrow." So Moses said, "May it be according to your word, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. The frogs will depart from you and your houses and your servants and your people. They will be left only in the Nile." Well, now, everything is hunky-dory between Pharaoh and Moses. This is even though the magicians of Egypt, the Pharaoh's magicians, used their secret arts and they made frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Well, now, I don't know why that would have been like such a miracle. Already there was frogs everywhere. Already had come up out of the Nile, so you add a few more. Why is that making such a big demonstration of demonic power? It seems like a real demonstration of demonic power would be to make the frogs go back in the river, which they didn't do. It was probably just a few frogs that these conjurers, these magicians conjured up. Demonic miracles are only a pale counterfeit of the real thing, and this was sort of pitiful. And I wonder, how did Pharaoh distinguish the demonic frogs that were sent up out of the Nile and the ones sent by God? I don't know, but he wasn't impressed by this, because he asked Moses to pray to God for him. He said, "Entreat the Lord that he may remove the frogs from me." The magicians couldn't do it. So Pharaoh says, "Well, Moses, maybe your God can do it. Get these frogs out of here." Now, note in the first plague, turning the water into blood, Pharaoh ignored Moses completely. He just walked back into his house. "Ah, heck with you, Moses." Well, he's a little bit more friendly to Moses now. He says, "Hey, entreat the Lord and I'll let you go." "I will let the people go," Pharaoh says, "they may sacrifice to the Lord." He was a liar, like most politicians. He was a liar. Now, notice that Pharaoh calls Yahweh, Yahweh, here in verse 8. He says, "Entreat Yahweh that he remove the frogs." Entreat the Lord in English, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. "Entreat Yahweh that he remove the frogs from me." Now, apparently, Pharaoh's getting to know who God is, a little up close and personal. A God that can put frogs all over the land, can turn all the Nile into blood-red water. Who is this God? You know, God had already told Pharaoh he was going to teach him who he was. Exodus 3:13-14. He's going to give him his name, Yahweh. Exodus 3:13. "Then Moses asked God, if I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What should I tell them?" Verse 14. God replied to Moses, "I am who I am." And remember, Yahweh is he is who he is. It's a different grammatical form of the to be verb. In Hebrew, God replied to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you're to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you." So Pharaoh is getting to know who I am is. Now notice how respectful Moses is. No schadenfreude here. Ha ha, I gotcha. No exulting at the downfall of an opponent. Moses said to Pharaoh, "The honor is yours to tell me. When do you want me to get rid of these frogs? By praying to Yahweh." Now, Moses set a time because he wanted to prove that the removing of the frogs would not be to chance or natural causes. If Moses had just said, "Well, sometime in the future, Yahweh is going to remove those frogs," and the frogs left the next day, Pharaoh could say, "Well, that's just a natural thing. The frogs decided to go back to the water." But no, Moses is going to set a time because the miracle was in the timing, as we said. Now, you would think that Pharaoh would say, "Let's do it now. Why wait till tomorrow? Let's do it now." Well, it could be Pharaoh was hoping that the frogs would go away on their own before tomorrow, and then he could say, "Your God didn't do anything. The frogs did it on their own." That would rob God of his glory, which Pharaoh would love to do. Or perhaps Pharaoh wrongly thought that it was necessary for Moses to participate in elaborate rites and ceremonies, and those rites and ceremonies had to be planned in order to get those frogs out of the river. Not so. All Moses had to do was say the word. But Pharaoh didn't understand that. Maybe that's why he gave Moses till the next day. I frankly think he was hoping the frogs would go away on their own. He said, "Well, I can stand it for one more day. I'll put up with it for one more day, and maybe they'll go away on their own, and Moses won't get any glory out of it. God won't get any glory. Yahweh." Exodus 8, verses 12 through 15. "Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. The Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, the courts, and the fields. So they piled them in heaps, and the land became foul. But when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not listen to them as the Lord had said." Now, the frogs probably died because they had eaten the blood-red algae in the Nile, and that's probably why they had left the Nile, and they were probably sick from eating that poisonous red algae. This is according to the NIV Study Bible, and which is a perfectly natural process, so the miracle here would be in the timing of the death of the frogs, not the actual death of the frogs. The land became foul. I wonder why God didn't have the frogs march back into the Nile. Well, Adam Clark says the frogs dying on the land and making the land stink was a continual sign that God was still displeased with this Pharaoh and his Egyptian servants. Clark also says that the frogs probably stayed there in order to draw flies to prepare the land for the plague of flies, which is coming up. Plague number 4. We're at frogs are plague number 2. The gnats are at plague number 3. Now note how God is sovereignly weaving Pharaoh's free choices in with natural events. Here's a quote along that line from Adam Clark. God never works a miracle when the end can be accomplished by merely natural means. And in the operations of divine providence, we always find that the greatest number of effects possible are accomplished by the fewest causes. As therefore the natural means for this fourth plague had been miraculously provided by the second. Clark here is referring to the plague of flies had been miraculously provided by the second plague of frogs, the frogs dying which drew the flies. The divine being had a right to use the instruments which he had already prepared. In other words, God can use natural means, and that's something a lot of charismatics have trouble with. Charismatics, extreme charismatics on the opposite end of the spectrum from deists who think miracles never happen. Some charismatics think that perfectly natural processes are miracles. There is a middle ground on that issue. But even though the land was foul, stinking with dead frogs, and if you ever smelled a dead frog, oh my gosh, they stink. Oh golly, do they stink. Just one of them stinks. Can you imagine the whole land covered with these dead frogs? But even so, as bad as it was, Pharaoh saw that there was relief. He considered the fact that those frogs were dead was better than when they were alive, so there was some sort of relief. And so when he saw that relief, he hardened his heart. Now, we've talked many times about Pharaoh hardening his heart. He hardened his heart, and then God hardened his heart later, because God's hardening of Pharaoh's heart was God's punishment for Pharaoh previously hardening his heart. It does not mean that God has made Pharaoh a robot. All right, so much for plague number 2, the frogs. Now we go to plague number 3, the gnats. Exodus 8, verses 16 through 19. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth, that it may become gnats through all the land of Egypt. They did so, and Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the earth, and there were gnats on man and beast. All the dust of the earth became gnats through all the land of Egypt. The magicians tried with their secret arts to bring forth gnats, but they could not. So there were gnats on man and beast. Then the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God, because they couldn't do it. So this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Now the KJV translates the Hebrew word that we have as gnats here in the New American Standard. The KJV translates it as lice. So it turns out the Hebrew can mean either gnats, fleas, or lice. Those little critters are sort of closely related. You ever had lice? Woo! Had lice. You ever had your dog have fleas and the fleas get on you? You ever been down at the beach and had the no-see-ums come out of the sand and start biting you all over the place? Those things are a pestilence. They're horrible. And so they're all over Egypt. Now, what pagan Egyptian god was Yahweh poking fun at here? Geb, the Egyptian earth deity. The deity, Mother Earth, supplying the Egyptians with all kinds of good and gracious things that they need to exist. And all of a sudden now, the earth is belching forth gnats. And then they got killed. What kind of an earth deity would allow gnats to come from itself to plague Egyptians and then get killed? Now, in verse 16, it said it became gnats throughout all the land of Egypt. That would probably be with the exception of Goshen, where the Israelites were. Some say the Israelites in Goshen were affected too, but there's going to be 5 plagues where God says the Egyptians are separate from the Israelites. The Egyptians suffer the plague. The Israelites will not. Now, this is one of those plagues that's not mentioned whether the Israelites suffered that plague that the Egyptians did. But it seems to me that if God would, in 5 instances, spare the Israelites from the plague, he would do it with the other 5. So we're going to go with that. Now, here's a question that I cannot answer. Why were the magicians not able to get gnats out of the earth? I don't know why they weren't, but they weren't able to. The magician said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God," when they were not able to. That God is Elohim there, not Yahweh. They probably still considered Yahweh a petty tribal deity, as John Gill says, and so they just said God, a general word for God. This is the finger of whoever's up there. Now, one wonders what the magicians thought about the blood in the frogs. Did the magicians think that this was merely a trick? I don't think so. I mean, blood, the water all over the country is blood red, and there's frogs everywhere in your beds. No, that's not a trick. Well, they might have thought it was something natural that Moses and Aaron were taking credit for. Now, that's possible because it probably was something natural. Probably red algae, and then the frogs come out because they're poisoned by the red algae, then the frogs die. Well, the gnats weren't directly related to the frogs dying, but the flies, which is going to be plague number four, they were. So it could be that these magicians are seeing all this and saying, no, these are just natural occurrences, and Moses and Aaron are taking credit for that. Could be what they thought earlier with the blood red water of the Nile and the frogs, but now with the gnats, they said, oh, this is the finger of God. We can't do this. We don't know how they're doing it, but this is not a natural occurrence. This is God. This is the finger of God. They were at least beginning to fear God. Pharaoh was not, but his ministers were. Pharaoh's heart, on the contrary, was hardened. He did not listen to them. And Pharaoh's hardened heart had been forecast by the Lord. Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. When had the Lord said that? Exodus 7, verse 4, previous chapter. God told Moses, when he was back in Goshen after Pharaoh had snubbed him the first time about letting the people go, "When Pharaoh does not listen to you, Moses, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my host, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments." So God had already told Moses that Pharaoh would not listen, and that's why Moses here in verse 19, the author Moses says, Pharaoh did not listen as the Lord had said. He'd predicted it. We go now to verse 20 and 21, Exodus 8. "Now the Lord said to Moses, rise early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water, and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. For if you do not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies on you and on your servants and on your people and into your houses. And the houses of the Egyptians will be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground on which they dwell." Now, why did Pharaoh go to the water in the morning? Moses had approached Pharaoh at the water when he did the first plague, Nile water into blood. Same thing here with the fly plague, which is plague number four. Moses was down at the water. Four options as to why he was at the water. John Gill says he could have just been taking a morning walk. Option number two, he might have been seeing some priestly divinations being done next to the water to worship the Nile River. If so, that's a perfect time to confront him. You worshiping your Nile River God, Hoppy? Well, guess what? I got something bigger than that. You're going to have flies everywhere here pretty soon. Option number three is to why Pharaoh was at the water. He wanted to see how much the river had ascended. Of course, that was his kingly duty to determine the rising of the Nile in order that crops could be planted properly and so forth. That would determine prosperity for the next year. Or the fourth reason he went down to the Nile, he just wanted to take a bath. But at any rate, he was down at the water. Moses says, Pharaoh, let my people go, or there are going to be swarms of flies. I'm going to send them to you. Four swarms of flies all over the land. Now, flies would have multiplied rapidly, not only because of the dead frogs from plague number two, but also because from plague number one of the receding water of the Nile, all that red algae stuff that had come out. And when water recedes, it leaves little pools that flies love to fly around in. So you got receding water, stagnant pools, and flies all over the place. Can you imagine how it stunk? And these flies and these receding backwaters would have multiplied rapidly. Now note how natural means are sovereignly woven together with supernatural means. As I've already noted several times, as the NIV Study Bible points out, it's just like when we get to the plague of locusts, God got rid of them using a west wind. He used natural means to get rid of the supernatural effects of a plague. Now, which idol was God making fun of here? Well, the Egyptians worshiped flies. They worshiped about everything that lived. So the judgment was appropriate. That fly's name was Wadjet. Like, what'd you do that for? Wadjet. Spelled U-A-T-C-H-I-T. It's not spelled the way it sounds. Idols always turn on your worshipers. You worship a fly, the next thing you know, the flies are eating you up. You worship money, the money will eat you up sooner or later. You worship a certain member of the opposite sex, and she or he will eat you up, and you will be destroyed. That's the way idolatry works. Here's a quote from an internet site about Wajit. Quote, the Egyptian deity usually associated with flies. Usually the Hebrew word in Exodus is swarm. Actually, the Hebrew word in Exodus is swarm. So this Egyptian deity, usually associated with flies, is the goddess Wajit. She is the lady of the marshes where papyrus grows and many insects live. She is known as goddess of the flame and the noonday heat. All right, we now turn to Exodus 8, verses 22 through 24. But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen. This is God speaking to Moses. But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people are living, so that no swarms of flies will be there, in order that you may know that I, the Lord, am in the midst of the land. I will put a division between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign will occur. Now this is the Lord speaking to Moses, telling Moses what he's supposed to say to Pharaoh. That's why he says, I will put a division between my people, God's people, my people, referring to the Lord's people, and your people, referring to the Pharaoh's people. Tomorrow the sign will occur. That's what Moses is supposed to relate to Pharaoh. Then the Lord did so, and there came great swarms of flies into the house of Pharaoh and the houses of his servants, and the land was laid waste because of the swarms of flies in all the land of Egypt. Now the fact that the Hebrews were set apart in the land of Goshen, remember the land of Goshen is that fertile area at the northeast extremity of Egypt, which bordered on the southwest extremity of Israel, right around the, if you look at the Mediterranean Sea as a clock, right around 4 o'clock, right around there, the Israelites were set apart, which means that they didn't have any flies come upon them. No swarms of flies will be there. Now, this being a set apart from the plagues is mentioned in 5 of the 10 plagues. I'm going to read that for you as I go through here. The fourth plague was the flies, and that's right here. The people in the land of Goshen, the Hebrews, were set apart. The fifth plague, which is the death of the livestock, we read this, Exodus 9, verses 4 through 6. But the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing of all that the Israelites own will die. Dot, dot, dot. All the Egyptian livestock died, but none among the Israelite livestock died. Here's the seventh plague. This is the hail. The only place it didn't hail was in the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were. Separation there, distinction. Here's the ninth plague. This is the darkness. One person could not see another, and for 3 days, this is in Exodus 10, verse 23, one person could not see another, and for 3 days they did not move from where they were. Yet all the Israelites had light where they lived. Distinction. The tenth plague, of course, was the death of the firstborn. And we know about that. That's the Passover, Exodus 11, 7. But against all the Israelites, whether people or animals, not even a dog will snarl, so that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. So the firstborn of the Egyptians died. Firstborn of the Israelites in the land of Goshen did not die. So that's 5 plagues where the Israelites were protected. From that, we can extrapolate that in the other 5 plagues, the Israelites didn't experience judgment, didn't experience the plagues at all, either. Now, we can't prove that, but I just think Moses didn't mention it in those 5 plagues, but it seems to me that if God refrains from judging the Israelites in 5 of the plagues, he would probably refrain from judging the Israelites in the other 5 of the plagues. Now, what's the great application of this as America has just jumped off the cliff here, and in the as we're in day 2 or day 3 of the leftist, anti-Christian, petty little antichrist who now control our culture and our government, House, Senate, and President. And as the church continues its apostasy and its slow swirling on down the toilet hole of deadness, institutionalism, legalism, and as the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah prepares for the inevitable judgment, what's the implication of that? Is this, God can judge any nation and still protect his people in the midst of the judgment. There's a lot of Christians going around that are extremely frightened. They say, oh, the end is near. Reading a bunch of that or listening to a bunch of that panic porn eschatology, Hal Lindsey, Tim LaHaye, all nuclear war, black helicopters, 200 million man armies of Chinese, 10 nations run by the world, Antichrist with a big computer somewhere in Europe and all this nonsense. And so they're afraid of judgment. Folks, Egypt experienced a horrible judgment. Guess what? The people of God were protected in the midst of it. We could also mention Noah's Ark, remember? The people of the world experienced a horrible judgment. They were all wiped out, but God protected his faithful remnant. So, not to worry. Now, in verse 24, it said the land of Israel, the land of Egypt, was laid waste because of the swarms of flies in the land of Egypt. Laid waste, that means the Egyptians could not cultivate their land, so they were facing famine. Exodus 8, verses 25 through 27. Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Go, sacrifice to your God within the land." So Pharaoh's starting to soften up a little bit, but he still puts a little caveat on it. Sacrifice where? Within the land. Not 3 days' journey that Moses had asked for, 3 days away, but within the land. Verse 26, Exodus 8. But Moses said, "It is not right to do so, for we will sacrifice to the Lord our God what is an abomination to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice what is an abomination to the Egyptians before their eyes, will they not then stone us? We must go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he commands us." Now, I'm convinced that Moses was planning to take the people of God, the Hebrews, out of Egypt and skedaddle on up to the promised land, but he's just trying to snooker the Pharaoh here. But he's not going to be totally open about his intentions because that would be, of course, suicidal. And so he still puts out this idea he's got to go on a 3 days' journey. And he gives a good reason because the Egyptians, as we know, sacrificed to any animal that existed. And when the Israelites would offer a sacrifice to Yahweh, it would be by sacrifice an animal the Egyptians loved, and they'd get their religious selves in a high dudgeon, and they would then riot and kill the Hebrews. That's a perfectly reasonable suggestion, a possibility that Moses is bringing up to Pharaoh. But Pharaoh wasn't willing to let them sacrifice at Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, in the wilderness, and that's why Moses didn't accept the offer. Now, if Moses was not trying to hoodoo Pharaoh, and he was sincerely trying to go out into the wilderness to sacrifice to God, and God hadn't revealed to him yet his full plan, well, if that's what his goal was, well, he still had reason to ask the Pharaoh to go to Mount Horeb instead of sacrificing in Goshen, because the Egyptians would have killed him in Goshen. They couldn't have gotten away with it. They would have been upset. Now, why were these animals that the Hebrews would sacrifice an abomination to the Egyptians? Well, the Israelites mainly sacrificed ox and sheep, and the Egyptians held oxen and sheep sacred. Now, John Gill says there's a question whether oxen and sheep and goats and so forth, which were eaten by the Hebrews, were at that early stage still worshipped, at that early stage worshipped by the Egyptians, though they were in later times. I don't know. I suspect they were. Otherwise, why would Moses be so concerned about it? Let's see what Adam Clark says about the Egyptians and their religious attitudes. Quote, "Perhaps few people were more superstitious than the Egyptians. Almost every production of nature was an object of their religious worship. The sun, moon, planets, stars, the river Nile, animals of all sorts, from the human being to the monkey, dog, cat, and ibis, and even the onions and leeks which grew in their gardens. Jupiter was adored by them under the form of a ram, Apollo under the form of a crow, Bacchus under that of a goat, and Juno under that of a heifer. The reason why the Egyptians worshipped those animals is given by Eusebius, viz., that when the giants made war on the gods, they were obliged to take refuge in Egypt and assume the shapes or disguise themselves under different kinds of animals in order to escape. Jupiter hid himself in the body of a ram, Apollo in that of a crow, Bacchus in a goat, Diana in a cat, Juno in a white heifer, Venus in a fish, and Mercury in the bird ibis." Boy, that's paganism for you. That's polytheism. You see why that type of religion didn't perdure. Now, besides sacrificing the Egyptian sacred animals, and some other reasons the Hebrews may have been stoned carrying out this sacrifice in Goshen instead of Mount Sinai, is because the Hebrews were shepherds, and shepherds were traditionally despised by the Egyptians. For years, it was thought the famous Hyksos kings that came into Egypt were shepherds, according to Manetho, and they were cruel and horrible, but now modern scholarship doubts that. They said it's bad translation. It shouldn't be shepherd kings. It should be foreign kings. And some scholars say they weren't necessarily evil and cruel, like Manetho said, the famous Egyptian historian and chronicler said. So I don't know about that, about the shepherd kings, but we do know that shepherds tended to be hated by the Egyptians. Because we know that, not from history, but from the scriptures, Genesis 46:34, This is God saying to Joseph, you shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. That's why they were up there separated out from the Egyptians to start with. The Hebrews were shepherds. Shepherds were loathsome to the Egyptians, so they moved up to Goshen. They were settled in Goshen, away from the mass of Egyptians. So it could be that even if it weren't for the fact of sacrificing oxen and sheep, which were sacred to the Egyptians, it could be just because they were shepherds. They didn't want to be around there having a big religious festival when the Egyptians hated shepherds. Two good reasons to get out of town, to go 3 days journey away. Moses reiterates to Pharaoh, we must go a 3 days journey. Now, 3 days could be literal 3 days, or it could just mean a round number, an expression for a long period of time. But we must go on a 3 days journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he commands us. Well, when did God command? Well, the tense of that verb can be translated either past or future. You could say, as he has commanded us. Well, if it's in the past, that would be in Exodus 3:10, where God said to Moses at the burning bush, therefore go, I am sending you to Pharaoh so that you may lead my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. In which case, the out of Egypt, either to sacrifice or to escape slavery, not really clear, but the point is that they're supposed to leave, and that's how our God has commanded us. And so when Moses tells Pharaoh we need to leave as God commands us, well, that's, he did command them in Exodus 3:10. He commanded Moses before. He wasn't telling a fib there at all. We go now to Exodus 8:28 and 29. Pharaoh said, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only you shall not go very far away. Make supplication for me. Then Moses said, behold, I am going out from you, and I shall make supplication to the Lord that the swarms of flies may depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people tomorrow. Only do not let Pharaoh deal deceitfully again in not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. So the Pharaoh's gradually loosening up after the changing of the Nile water into blood, and after Moses changing his staff into a snake, Pharaoh just stiffed Moses completely, walked into his house and said, nuts to you. Absolute refusal. That was the first plague, the water in the Nile plague. And then the frog plague was number two. The Pharaoh gave permission to leave, but then he reneged on that permission and said, no, I changed my mind. My heart's hard and you're not going to go. Now, after the gnats plague, which was plague number three, Moses absolutely refused and wouldn't let the Hebrews go. So Moses is gradually breaking him down, and God's gradually breaking him down. John Gill speculates that the reason Pharaoh doesn't want to let them go far away because he had heard of the Hebrews longing for the promised land. You know, that's in the Hebrew psyche and the Hebrew consciousness. Wouldn't surprise me at all if Pharaoh knew what they thought about the promised land. It's just right around the corner up there in Canaan. So he said, yeah, you can go. You can go sacrifice, but you can't go very far. Now, in verse 29, Moses said, hey, Pharaoh, don't deceive me again. Don't act deceitfully again in not letting the people go. When had Pharaoh deceived Moses before? Well, he had deceived him in the frog plague. As I mentioned, Pharaoh had reneged on the permission that he had given in the frog plague. In Exodus 8:8, we read this. Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, appeal to the Lord to remove the frogs from me and my people. Then I will let the people go and they can sacrifice to the Lord. That was verse 8, verse 15 in Exodus 8. But when the Pharaoh saw there was relief, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them as the Lord had said. So Moses called off the frogs, and Pharaoh finked out on his promise to let them go. So Moses said, Pharaoh, you've already deceived us one. Don't do it again. You finked out on us when you got hit with frogs, and now you're getting hit with flies. Don't betray us again with your phony promises. Exodus 8 verses 30 through 32. So Moses went out from Pharaoh and made supplication to the Lord. Notice that Pharaoh had asked. He's getting so desperate now. With all those flies, I can imagine. He says, not only flies, but he's got dead frogs everywhere. Flies, the war. Yeah, it's just a mess. So the Pharaoh says, make supplication for me. Pray for me. That's the beginning of wisdom. When you get in so much trouble, you have to ask God to help you, to pray for you. Exodus 8, 30 through 32. So Moses went out from Pharaoh and made supplication to the Lord. That's for Pharaoh. In other words, stop the flies, Lord. The Lord did as Moses asked and removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh, from his servants and from his people. Not one remained. But Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also, and he did not let the people go. So with the frog plague number two, and now with the flies plague number four, Pharaoh has given permission and then reneged on that permission. A real work of art, this Pharaoh is. How did God remove the swarms of flies? A couple of options from John Gill. God could have destroyed them all at once, or he could have driven them away with the wind, just as he drove the locust away with the wind later, which we'll see as we move on into Exodus. Pharaoh hardened his heart again and again. Notice this is Pharaoh hardened his heart. Sometimes it's God hardened, sometimes it's Pharaoh hardened. Because Pharaoh hardens his heart and God is in judicial punishment of that, then hardens Pharaoh's heart even worse. By the way, the application for that is you see people that sin, and of course they suffer the wages of sin, which is death and trouble and all that, and then you find out that they don't care. They sin more and they sin more and they go down in a deep cycle, because what happens is the sin hardens their heart and the punishment of the sin is part of the death that the sin is bringing on them. It's a terrible thing to get in bondage to sin, because sin punishes you. It hardens your heart and makes you want to sin some more. And the only way you get out of it is by the inestimable grace of God. Pharaoh doesn't want to let the people go because he wanted their slave labor, as Adam Gill says. And remember, Israelite slavery was a lot different than African slavery in America, because the Egyptians didn't have to feed and clothe and take care of the sick and old and adjudicate their disputes and all that like the southern slaveholders. Well, they were northern slaveholders too, like the American slaveholders had to do. The Israelites had to do all that. The Israelites had to feed themselves, clothe themselves. They had to take care of the sick. They had to take care of the old. They had to deliver the babies. They had to do all that. The Hebrews just sat there and says, work and give us the bricks. And he didn't want to let all that go. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Exodus 8. And now we are ready to proceed to Exodus chapter 9. In our next audio, verses 1 through 35, we will talk about the fifth plague, when the Egyptian livestock will be struck down and killed. I hope you stay tuned for that happy story, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.